Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron Brooks Show. This is Elon Jerno sitting in for Ron. Welcome. It's great to be here with you. I am excited to talk to you again this week. I was here last time, and I'm going to plug that show. If you haven't listened to it, pick it up on the podcast. I'm going to be picking up some of the themes from last time today. Here's a preview of what we're going to talk about today. I've got a special guest, which I'll introduce in a moment, and he's here to talk about a minor thing like changing society. How do you reshape the world? So not to put any pressure on you, Keith, my colleague Keith Lockage is here. We're going to talk about that. Another topic that is coming up, radicalization, and I put that in air quotes. What is it? Do we understand it? And does it matter? And this is in the context of the radicalization that you hear about in the context of terrorists and Islamists and so on. One more topic I'm hoping to get to is the so-called Ben Rhodes scandal. If you've heard about this, one of Obama's foreign policy advisors has been raked over the coals for his comments in a New York Times article about his role in selling the Iran nuclear deal, and there's a lot to say about that. So that's just a preview, and I'm hoping to get time to run a contest, as we've done previously, so I think it'll be a bit of fun about with you guys, and I've got, I think, a more challenging question than last time, so I'll tell you more about that as we go. So welcome to the program. Let's start with this question. What does it look like, or what does it take to reshape a culture and a society? How do you change the world, to use that overused expression? Well, last week I talked about an issue that relates to that, and I think if you recall, and you can grab the podcast for last week's episode, I talked a lot about this issue of the foreign policy elite and what does that mean and how to think about it. One of the broader points that I made is that intellectuals have a special role in the culture, and their role is really important. That's not a new observation with me. This is Ayn Rand's point. She had a definite view about the importance of professional intellectuals in the modern world, and she thought their function was dispensable. Now, it's very important. This is the point I made in talking about the so-called foreign policy elite. If intellectuals are to do their job properly, if they're going to be productive and add value, they should have the right ideas and guide society in the right direction. So I want to give you a flavor of what Ayn Rand's view is, because I think this is central to thinking about what does it look like to change society. This is what Ayn Rand said about the role of professional intellectuals. Quote, the professional intellectual carries the application of philosophical principles to every field of human endeavor. He sets a society's course by transmitting ideas from the so-called, this is my words, quote-unquote, ivory tower of the philosopher to the university professor, to the writer, to the artist, to the newspaper man, to the politician, to the movie maker, to the nightclub singer, to the man in the street. I'm skipping over some material. Back to the quote. The intellectual is the eyes, ears, and voice of a free society. It is his job to observe the events of the world, to evaluate their meaning, and to inform the men in all the other fields. End quote. Now that, I think, is a distinctive and important view about the role of intellectuals. Those were Ayn Rand's words. Now, this is a theme that has come up repeatedly on the Ron Brooks Show. If you listen to Ron's last podcast program, he was on the topic of what's going on in South America and the U.S. And part of his argument in that episode was he picked up on the role of intellectuals in America in shaping our society and the ideas that have impacted us. And I think the summary there is that they've been spreading the wrong ideas. They've been spreading irrational ideas, collectivist ideas. And the effects are part of what he was criticizing, the kind of mindlessness, dependence, and alienation that we see in America today. So I don't think we can say enough to emphasize the importance of intellectuals in society. what is the solution? What do you do about this? That if you have intellectuals who are not advocating the right ideas, irrational ideas, and they're harming the world we live in and our freedom is in jeopardy. Well, I think obviously you need to do is to call them out and criticize them and expose what they're saying and refute it. But you also need to counteract them. And I think that's important. That's part of what we do here at the Institute. But I think there's a long game. There's a long-term vision for what needs to happen. And that is to think about what is the positive. What should intellectuals be doing? What kind of intellectuals do we need in a society? And bring up a new cadre of what Ayn Rand called the new intellectuals, which I think have an important role to fill. Okay, so that's a, sort of a snapshot of what I think is important in understanding how a society moves, what shapes it, the ideas and how they transmit, and Ayn Rand's explanation for that, her view on it. Now, I want to take a different perspective on this because a lot of what I've just said is, here's what you do to combat the negative, and I think that is important. But there's a lot to say about how do you advocate for the positive? How do you advocate for the real values that are crucial to a free society? So you could take the same issue and look at it from this perspective. If you care about working towards a future of reason, of egoism, and of capitalism, if you want to see the prosperity that is possible and the progress that human beings can achieve when they're free, then what kind of world do you need and how do you get there? Now, here at the Institute, our view is that what you need is an intellectual foundation for a free society. You need the philosophy of objectivism, and that is what we spend every minute advocating and explaining and teaching people about. Now, that's a big project. How do you do that? Well, concretely, you have to think about where there's opportunity, what are the leverage points, and there's a lot to say about that. If you're coming to the Objectivist Summer Conference this year, Yaron Brook and others of my colleagues will have presentations about what that looks like. There's a lot to say. I want to pick up on one aspect of this, and this ties in with the question of how do you change society, how do you shape the world in the vision of your values. Now, we have a program here at the Institute that's been running in various forms for, I want to say, upwards of 30 years. I first got connected to it about 20 years ago. It wasn't called what it is today, and I'm referring to the Objectivist Academic Center. But it is a supremely important program, and it's kind of funny when I talk to people who know a little about the Institute or what we do, one of the things that comes out is they get that it's important, but it's almost like a well-kept secret. They don't know a lot about it. They don't understand where it fits in with what we do. So I've called my colleague Keith Lockich to join us today. I want to talk to him about the Objectivist Academic Center and basically ask, well, where does it fit in and how does it serve the Institute's mission? Why is this important if you care about a future of freedom? Who cares? What does this do for us? So Keith Lockich, Dr. Keith Lockich has a background in physics. And for more than 10 years now, he's been teaching at the Objectivist Academic Center. And he is our vice president for educational programs. Keith, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Elon.
So let me ask you that devil's advocate question. So where does the OIC business come from and why does it matter?
Yeah, well, it all gets back to the quote that you read from Ayn Rand and her view that it's philosophy that shapes history and that shapes the culture. And the dominant philosophy in a culture is determined by the ideas of the philosophers, of the intellectuals, of professional intellectuals, people whose profession is to think and write about ideas. So if that's true, then it's important if you want to try to change the culture, if you want to inject a new philosophy or change the framework that people use to think about issues, you need to develop a new, as you said, a new cadre of intellectuals who can play that role in the culture. So ARI has always held it to be an important aspect of its mission to have training programs, advanced training programs for those new intellectuals. So this is something that we've been doing almost since the beginning of the Institute. You know, it all started in the late 80s with a few people, you know, who took phone seminars from Harry Binswanger, who, you know, listeners of the show will be familiar with. You know, some of whom are now ARI board members and tenured philosophy professors.
Just to interrupt you, so one of the students who joined the program some years after its initial launch was Yaron Brook, and another one is our colleague Ankar Gatte, and they both went through earlier iterations of this, what became the OAC?
Yeah, so so ARI has always had some form of training programs. Okay. So we're having some technical issues with the microphones here. Is that good? All right. So ARI has always had some form of advanced training programs for people who are interested in becoming professional intellectuals. And the idea is, you know, to become a professional intellectual is a years-long endeavor. Let's say you want to become a philosophy professor. You know, to become a professor of philosophy requires that you go through your undergraduate degree, you get accepted into grad school. You know, if you get a tenure track position, it's many years before you achieve tenure. And to you, the steps that you have to go through to achieve that goal are very rigorous and very difficult. You've got to become a master of the knowledge in your field, and you've got to you know, understand how ideas are communicated in that field and how to work within your profession and what it takes to have to achieve success in an academic career. Now, on top of that, if you want to be an objectivist professor, you not only have to do all the things that anyone who wants to become a philosophy professor has to do, but you also have to master the philosophy of objectivism, which in many ways, you know, has complexities of its own. The thinking methodology that is involved is in some ways distinct and unique relative to the kinds of thinking methods that are employed in the profession. So, you know, it takes a huge amount of training and a huge amount of thinking and a huge amount of work. And ARI has always felt that it's very important to support people who are trying to move in that direction by supplying the objectivism side of the training.
Yeah, I guess
the other question to follow up on that is, can people find this someplace else? Because, you know, why the Institute? Why us? I mean, isn't this another way? Are there other ways to get this?
Sorry, we're just having some technical issues with the microphones here. So could you repeat the question?
Why us? Why not someplace else?
Oh. Well, I mean, I think the expertise on objectivism just doesn't exist anywhere else. I mean, let me just say a broader point here about becoming an objectivist intellectual. Anybody, if you come to OCON and you see the speakers, or, you know, if you read articles, you look, you know, if you follow the objectivist movement, anybody who speaks and writes with some connection to objectivism has had some form of training. You know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, Leonard Peikoff gave very monumental substantive courses on all aspects of objectivism. And anybody who is an objectivist intellectual today, you know, has gone through those courses and made a study of the philosophy. You know, they've read Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, and studied it. They've taken Dr. Peikoff's Understanding Objectivism course. You know, they've taken Objectivism, the State of the Art, and all these courses where very intricate and technical issues come up that are relevant to understanding and working with the ideas. What we try to do in the OAC, we use a lot of Dr. Peikoff's material in the program, and what we try to do is there is a certain focus on thinking methodology and how to, not just what the content of the ideas is, but how to understand them.
So Keith, I want to just ask you a little to get a flavor of what it is that happens in the classroom. So I've done some teaching as a guest instructor, and you've done a lot of the teaching lately, and Ankar Agade has done a lot of teaching. What is it like for the student? What is the experience, and what are some of the results or feedback you get from them?
it's a distance learning program. So people take the courses. We used to do it by phone conference. Now we use a video platform. So, you know, people can see each other on little webcams and things like that. I mean, so in concretely, that's what the experience is like. You call into class. Usually the classes are in the evenings, late afternoon, evening, Pacific time, so that people on the East Coast can also participate. And, you know, we have classes. So the program has changed over the years. For a long time, we had a program that was broken up into 4 years. So there was a first year where there was an introduction to philosophy as such, not necessarily objectivism, but just introduction to philosophy and an introduction to communication. We focused on writing. And then there would be a full year devoted to an in-depth study of objectivism. And then there would be a year that focused on thinking methodology, and then we'd revisit the issue of communication. For various reasons, due to other priorities, when we went to work on our website, that required a huge amount of time and effort from the teaching staff. And so we scaled back the OAC program into a one-year program, which focused on philosophy and communication, sort of condensed down into 1 year. What we're planning to do for the fall is actually relaunch a 3-year version of the program. What we found is that we really need to have a student over a period of years to get the full benefit of the training in methodology and the training in communication skills. So what students will find in the new program that we're launching is that there will, over the course of the 3 years, there will be an in-depth study of objectivism, but also contrasted with other philosophical systems. There'll be a focus on communication skills, speaking and writing, as we've had in the past. And there'll be this focus on thinking methodology. I think one of the things that people were often surprised by who have been through the program is, we don't always necessarily have opportunities to really reflect on our method of thinking and whether that methodology can be improved. And so it can be really eye-opening to take what this component of the program, and part of what you do is we take part of Leonard Peikoff's Understanding Objectivism course, and he deals with issues like rationalism. You know, this is
Yeah, let me just ask you this. So Ayn Rand is an advocate of reason. So just break down, what is rationalism? How could that be a bad thing? What exactly is that?
Yeah, so reason obviously is good, and to be rational, rationality is a virtue. Rationalism is a kind of warped version of, it's a warped thinking methodology that consists of reasoning detached from concrete observations and thinking that's grounded in reality. So when somebody sort of spins logical castles in the air, and very quickly it becomes detached from any connection with, you know, a concrete example or a real life application or just real world data, that's a symptom of rationalism. And I mean, this is rampant in academia. If you've attended a graduate or upper level philosophy seminar, you're steeped in this kind of thing every day, where you'll start off with some statement and then start spinning a logical process deducing from that statement, and all of a sudden you're floating off in the clouds.
So if you were to put this point a different way, so the vision for what we are trying to get students to come away with is what it looks like to have kind of a Rourke-like grasp of it, like a first-handed view. What does it mean to hold objectivism as a real philosophy? Is that accurate?
Yeah. So it's rigorous, deep philosophical thinking that is at the same time grounded in concrete reality and grounded in real-world data and facts and observations.
So I've only done some guest teaching for the program, so I don't have as deep a knowledge of it as you, and you've been involved in thinking about the strategy and the overall ways to improve it. I'm just curious, what kind of responses have you had from the students that have gone through whatever version it is that they were doing at the time?
Yeah, I mean, the
we get a lot of positive feedback from the students who stick with it and go through the whole program. Someone once described it as it's like getting a black belt in objectivism. We put a lot of emphasis in the later years on communication skills. And I mean, Ayn Rand herself had important things to say about the principles of writing. We use her book, The Art of Nonfiction, as our textbook. Even people who've taken communications or rhetoric and so on in college find that they learn things about writing and about the writing process that they hadn't learned in college. You had one student who said that he learned more in, 1 year of taking writing in the OAC than he learned in 3 years at Stanford. So
one of the things that I've heard people, I often go to college campuses and I meet with students and I speak with them, and we have a lot of interns come through the Institute. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that, we have for a long time put a great deal of emphasis on people who are interested in being intellectuals. And I think that is true still. It's definitely an important part of the kind of person we're trying to reach through these programs. But what do you say to the people who aren't sure that this is what they want, and who might have, different goals? And, I started this topic by saying, if you want to change the world, there's a lot of things people do to change the world. It is not limited to intellectual work. And thinking of the objectivist movement sort of as a community of people working to advance these ideas, what do you say to people who come back with, I'm ambitious, I want to do stuff, I want to be the next Travis Kalanick, I want to do the next Uber, I want to disrupt education, I want to be at the cutting edge of scientific research. And those things are, I think you'll agree, those are ways to change the world. So does the program have anything to offer for them?
Yeah, I would say, this is something that we've learned over the years running this program. I think in the past, we really put an emphasis on people whose stated goal was to become a professional intellectual, whether that's going into academia or going into the policy think tank world, that the program was intended for those new intellectuals, construed as people whose goal is to actually become an intellectual as their professional career. Now, the thing is, that's obviously crucial, and we are still looking for people who have that as a goal. The reality is that's going to be a very small number of people, who are qualified and who are interested in doing the kind of work that's involved there. But what we've found is that there's a lot of value. So let's say somebody is really interested in objectivism and they don't want to become a philosophy professor, but they have the kind of leadership skills and the kind of entrepreneurial ability that they could be a founder of a company like Uber. It's interesting that you brought up Travis Kalanick, because he's an interesting example for the point that I'm about to make. You have a company like Uber that's being very radical and revolutionary in a certain economic space. They're completely disrupting the taxi industry, right? Now, what ends up happening is the stand that they're trying to take in their business field ends up sort of bumping up against the regulatory state and against fundamental views in our culture about the nature of government and about the role of regulation in society. And imagine the impact that someone, a Travis Kalanick type person, could have if he was not only someone who had the business acumen to do what he's doing, and he's obviously very impressive in that respect, but also has the philosophic framework and the intellectual skills to be able to articulate the stand that he's taking. Now, I don't mean to imply that to be critical of Uber. Uber has taken, very impressive and firm stands. They're actually one of a company that I look to as being very heroic in this area. But the ability to articulate the philosophical premises and the arguments behind the stand that they're taking, could the impact could be magnified just enormously. So what we're looking for in the program, the kind of people that we want to get in the program, is not just, you know, the would-be professional intellectual. We want the would-be professional intellectuals, and it's the key part of our mission is to bring those people in and to train them. But we're also interested in anybody who's really ambitious and is entrepreneurial and seeks a leadership role in society, and who wants to do that from a solid intellectual framework, and who wants to be intellectual in whatever line of work that they're in. I mean, you know, the character of Hank Reardon in The Fountainhead, the character of Hank Reardon in Atlas Shrugged is a perfect example of this, because he's able to articulate in various parts of the novel the intellectual reasons for the stands that he's taking as they develop, in a way that you just don't see businessmen doing today.
Yeah, I think that's worth really emphasizing. And I agree with you. I actually admire Uber as well. I think they've been heroic in this respect. And I talk to people who work there whose job it is to think about how to push up against local regulations, and they come up with incredible solutions to this. And they're really, one of the things that's distinctive about them, I think, and admirable, is that there's a certain kind of moral confidence in what they're doing. They basically move in, and then they kind of set up shop, and then they have to fight back. The city has to come back and say, well, you can't do this, and then they can answer, well, we have been doing it, and nothing bad has happened, which is a really impressive thing. So I guess if you distill that issue of, what if business leaders or scientific leaders or people in all spheres, including especially people in intellectual spheres, what if they had that kind of confidence and the ability to articulate what they stand for? I mean, that to me would really change the tone in society and the kind of the way people even think about these issues. Because what you have today, and this is just kind of stepping away from the OAC a bit, there's this kind of craven and often appeasing mentality. And it's not to criticize people wholesale, but you definitely get a sense that people are afraid, and it's not that they're not sure what it looks like to stand up for themselves in many cases. And in some cases, you get bad actors and you get companies run by people who shouldn't be running them. I mean, imagine talking about changing the world. Imagine if there were five business leaders who had a tenth of what Uber has demonstrated. And another one of my heroes is John Allison, who ran BB&T for many years. One of the things that he did, BB&T did at the time of the Kelo case, if you remember, it's about 11 years ago, there was a major Supreme Court decision on eminent domain. And I won't get into the details of this case, but it was a really important case. And it from what I understand, it enabled more ways in which the government, or a broader scope for the government to use eminent domain to take private property for use for the so-called public good. And one of the things that BB&T, which is a major financial institution, did is they said, well, we won't finance ventures that are involved with eminent domain takings, which I think that is a really important stand to take. And I think part of that comes from my impression, John Allison has really thought about these issues, and he is serious about the role of ideas in life. And I think that kind of leadership is what I guess is so important.
Yeah, just to pick up on that point, I mean, to bring it to an issue that, you know, is very close to my interests, this RICO prosecution that's happening where in the climate change issue. So, you know, a bunch of state attorneys general have issued subpoenas to, I believe, Exxon and various other organizations, basically trying to accuse them of committing fraud with respect to their views on climate change. I mean, this is a total assault on freedom of speech. It's a pure attempt by government officials to intimidate and frighten people into submission. Now, some of the organizations that are involved, like the Competitive Enterprise Institute, have taken an incredibly courageous stand in fighting against them and you know, pushing back against this kind of persecution. But imagine if the business leaders themselves, if the CEO of Exxon would be willing to take a stand like this and to say the kinds of things to the state attorneys general that Hank Reardon says to the judges when he's on trial for, you know, an equally ridiculous alleged crime.
So one, just to sort of tie up some of the threads from this conversation, so taking it back to the Objectivist Academic Center, I mean, if I can tell you my perspective on it, so I've been through the early version of the OAC many years ago, and I helped to teach it a little, as I mentioned. It's a demonstration. So the point you've been raising is it's a demonstration that philosophy is inescapable. And if there's going to be change in society, we need intellectuals, but we also need people in other leadership roles in the movement and beyond that in the culture who have the right ideas and are willing to speak up for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just to sort of cap off our conversations, the Objectivist Academic Center, I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface of what I think of is the profound value of the program and some of the ways in which it's distinctive. Maybe we'll do another conversation. But I want to just ask, what do people need to do if they want to learn more or take part and just see if this is for them, or and if it's not for them, maybe it's for their friend or someone they know? Because I think one of the issues is just getting the word out is important, and making people aware, even if they never join the OAC, if they understand its role in what we do, I think it'll excite them more about what the Institute's about.
Yeah, so this is a fortuitous time for you to be asking that, because we're just about to update the copy on our website. So I won't send people to our website yet, because the copy there is still out of date. If you're listening to the show and this has inspired you, and you're interested in learning more about the OAC, just write to oac@aynrand.org. And maybe by the time the show airs, you know, the website will be updated and you can check that out. I mean, that's aynrand.org. And if you go to the students page, you'll find Objectivist Academic Center pretty readily.
All right, Keith, thanks for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thanks for having me on, Ilan.
All right, we'll be back after this short break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at aynrand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at aynrand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
The critics of income inequality say they are for social justice. But what does that mean? It means that if you are really productive, if you work hard, create a lot of wealth, and make a lot of money, you're doing something bad. You're creating inequality. So what's fair? Well, some say what's fair is to have the government take a bunch of your money and give it to other people. Why do these people deserve to be given money from others? The answer is because they didn't create much wealth. That's what it all comes down to. Social justice says we should punish people who have done nothing wrong for the sake of people who have not been wronged. On the other hand, justice says we should only punish people for the wrong they've done to others. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Welcome back to the Yaron Brook Show. I'm Ilan Jerno. I'm sitting in for Yaron this week. It's fun to be here. We just had Keith Lockich, my colleague, talking to us about the Objectivist Academic Center and how that has a role in creating the kind of leaders, intellectual and otherwise, who can change the world. So, and if you want to learn more about that, you can go to our website, aynrand.org, and find out about the program and some of our alumni. Details coming on the web. All right, I want to change direction and talk about a topic that is, I mean, it comes up all the time, and especially after a terrorist attack like the ones we've seen in Brussels and before them in Paris. And it's a continual theme. And the most recent article I read that triggered this segment the title goes something like this. Who will become a terrorist? Research yields few clues. And I read that, and this is a topic that I study and I'm interested in. And I think there's a lot to say here. It's a difficult topic. But the article, I want to give you a flavor of why this article caught my attention. I mean, the title is intriguing. It's a question people want to understand. Who becomes a terrorist? And apparently, according to this survey article, in the New York Times from March, the research doesn't add up to much. So here's a flavor of what the problem is. You know, after whatever attacks happen, there's a spurt in activity, and we're trying to figure out how to stop these. How do we get them at the source? What's happening? How do we understand the phenomenon? And some of the points made here are that as much as we hear various accounts of what leads people to take such actions, such attacks and murderous rampages and so forth, and bombings and suicide bombings, there isn't really one profile that they all fit. I mean, there are various kinds of backgrounds that people come from. And just to give two examples, the married couple who carried out the terrorist attack, or the Islamist shoot-up in San Bernardino, California last year, he worked for the city, and they lived in a regular neighborhood. Nothing, you couldn't point to poverty as an issue, which is sometimes what happens. He was, by all accounts, well enmeshed in the society and the community. And at the other end of this, you get people like the ones who carried out the attacks in Paris and in Brussels, who, you know, they came from poorer neighborhoods, and they, I don't think they had serious jobs, and some of them were petty criminals. So those are just two data points, obviously, and there are many you could look at. But clearly they don't fit the same holes. These are different pegs, different shaped pegs. So that's a problem, because if you have a narrative, a causal narrative about what leads people to take these drastic steps, these murderous attacks, it doesn't. When you have data that doesn't fit, what do you do with that? So that's one significant problem. Now, the article goes on to account for the way in which government has spent money funding research to try to solve some of these questions or answer these questions. And we're talking in the, you know, in the range of millions of dollars in grants and sort of government research funding. And the outcomes haven't been at all fruitful. So there's two problems that come out. One is when researchers find certain, reach conclusions that I think are or seemingly well supported by the evidence, that research doesn't make its way into policy thinking at all. So they, one example here is there's a scholar whose work from about 10 years ago, he found that he ran the numbers of data that was available on suicide bombers from various backgrounds. And he said that there's no link, according to his data, between economic distress and these kinds of terrorist acts. So whatever happened to that research finding? Well, it didn't really shape policy. In fact, the government, or the current administration, and even past administrations have the view, and it's a salient point that they make repeatedly, that poverty or money problems is a significant factor. So that directly contradicts the finding that if this research is well done, that doesn't really fit the research. The other kind of problem you get, so that's an example of when there are research findings and the policy is directly contrary to them. You get other kinds of research, other kinds of anomalies that are interesting. There's a big disconnect between research and policy in a different direction. And namely, there's sort of pet theories that the policymakers have that I don't think research could justify. I don't know how you would design the program, the investigations to do that. And one of the conclusions quoted in this article is the people making laws and coming up with policy solutions, they just don't have any grasp of the fact. They haven't done systematic research on the phenomenon. So that is, I mean, I read this article and part of it didn't surprise me. From the perspective that it's a difficult question and it's not obvious how you would tackle it. But it is distressing to find that to the extent that some of this research looks promising or even is well-founded or even well-supported, it just doesn't filter in. And it doesn't filter into the way policymakers think or shape their decisions. And presumably they are carrying out their policies based on other types of accounts that they think are have some basis to them. And the question is, what is that? So that was really troubling. So that got me thinking, and I've been reading into the literature lately, partly because it's an area of interest for me, but I also wanted to start forming a view of the state of the literature, because according to this account, there's a lot that leaves out, and it's not clear how good it is. So I've been reading into this, and I'm going to talk about the topic today, but I don't have a definite view yet. I'm still forming my view. But here are some things I found that are interesting and troubling as well. So this is not a topic I write about a lot, from the perspective that a lot of the research looks at it, and that is the intersection between the ideological factors, the ideas that animate these people, and the psychological dimension, because you can't really, in isolation, I think there's definitely a psychological component. To pretend otherwise is silly. And I'm not a psychologist, it's not my field, so there's definitely aspects of this that I just don't have clear views on. And when I write about the topic, I try to delimit what I say to the points that I do think are right and can be defended. As I've written about one of my recent articles at The Federalist talks about this in passing. You can read that on our website. But what I wanted to highlight is in reading some of the literature, so I went back to the early 2000s when there was a big spurt of research and published articles on what you might call terrorism studies, and there's different, and that isn't even specific enough because it becomes very, very specialized. And understandably, in the early 2000s, following 9/11, there was a big growth in this field. And having read some of these things, one of the things that struck me, and I think it goes some ways to explaining why there's such a disconnect between the way policy thinking happens and the way research happens and what they find. Here's a couple of things that struck me as odd and that you would want to think more about before designing your research program. Here's one question. So this is all framed in terms of radicalization. And I'm going to put that in air quotes. You can't see that on the radio, but I'll mention it. I'll try to change it, my tone when I use that word. Now, I don't mean that in any sarcastic way. I just mean that it's a term that deserves to be scrutinized. It's not clear what this conceptualization is trying to put together. And some of the evidence for that is that when you read some of these scholarly articles, and I'm referring here mainly to the ones by people in who are not psychologists. So I'm not looking at the psychological studies that I found them. They talk about radicalization, and sometimes there's a sense that it's something that happens to you, like catching a cold. You know, so I'm walking around, I'm at the airport, I go to the store, and I come home, and I've got a cold. It happened to me. And there's a way in which there's talk about, say, a jihadist becoming a killer that's similar to that. It's like, well, he was all right, and then suddenly he caught jihadism. And then, you know, understandably, he went out and shot people, blew himself up. Now, that is, I don't think that is the right way to think of it. And I think one reason that has some play and people are open to thinking about it that way is that radicalization as a way of thinking about this, as a framework, I think it just muddles the issue. Because what does it count on? Being radical, becoming radical, and that can... Leaving aside whether it's passive or active, which is an important issue, but just the idea that the framework is radical versus what? Versus moderate? Now, that is not a legitimate way to think of this. At most, you could talk loosely about people who have radical views, but that I think is a problem. It is not the right way to think about the way ideas work on people and the way that they accept them. There's definitely ways to characterize how some people are more consistent with certain ideas, they hold them more seriously, they apply them more consistently. There's definitely gradations in which people accept or hold or act on certain ideas or principles or premises. I don't think the axis of moderate versus radical is right. I think that is wrong. It's the wrong way to think of it. And it's a similar problem to the issue of extremism, which is something Ayn Rand has written a great deal about, as an example of a conceptualization that's designed to make our thinking, to cloud our thinking and hamper it. Now, I don't yet know enough about this field and the idea of radicalization to claim that it has been put together with the intention of clouding our thinking, but it's definitely not an obviously valid conceptualization. I'll say that, I find it very difficult to use and think about precisely because it counts on that background of radical versus moderate, which I don't think is the right way to think about an issue. Because what does it mean to be radical about freedom? What does it mean to be radical about truth? What does it mean to be moderate about truth? This is not a right way to think of this. Now, that's one issue that comes right off when you start digging into the literature. The other thing that struck me is, and I'm about, I don't know, 3 years into the readings here, going back in time, so there might be better work ahead as I read into this. But one of the things that struck me is that a number of these studies and articles come at the issue in a way that strikes me as backwards. It's sort of backing into an issue, and this is the way it takes form. So the question is set up as, what leads people to terrorism, and how do terrorist groups, this is another question that comes up, and this is what I've been researching, how do terrorist groups end? Like what is the cause of their disintegration, or their falling off the map, or their not being active in some way that we can measure? Okay. Well, it's interesting to ask what leads them to stop doing what they're doing, but who is the they and what are they after? And the interesting thing here that I characterize as they're backing into the question is they treat the primary as these are terrorist groups. And it's a secondary differentiation to say, and among them, there's different kinds of ideological motives, and they break these down into a number of types, which sort of makes sense, because there have been terrorist groups who are leftist, in the sense of they're socialist or communist, and there have been the terrorist groups that embrace terrorism for religious goals, and that is definitely Islamist groups, and there's also Christian groups, and there's even Jewish groups that do this. So there's definitely the religious side of it, and then there's the secular, and they often tend to be leftist when they're secular. And there's a few other distinctions that they make among them. And you think, like, the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, is a group that embraced terrorism, if we can use that term advisedly. Now, that is the farthest thing from a jihadist group, right? And it is not at all secular. At least in the conflict in which they're embroiling themselves, it's not an issue of they want to see a proletarian society. So in the way that other sort of red brigade type and the kind you see in Italy and in Germany in the 1970s, which were sort of hardcore leftists, and some in the United States too. I think the Weather Underground, Weathermen, I forget what their names were. But there's definitely groups like that. So that's surprising. So why would you start with their means of attack, terrorism, and then subdivide their ideology? Now, there could be good reasons for doing it that way. I mean, I can think of good reasons, but so far it doesn't strike me as the right way to think of the issue, or at least it's definitely problematic. And particularly when you turn to the question of not just what leads people to join these groups, or what makes these groups stop doing what they're doing, or the question as it's commonly framed in the literature is, how do they end? How do you stop them? What would it take? And they've collected the data, and they try to analyze it, and they say, well, here's what factors we think are relevant. But in my view, it's a very different kind of question to ask. What does it take to stop a religionist organization versus a group that has some goals in reality that you might point to that are political? So if you take a group that bombs a research laboratory because they claim that animals have rights, well, you can imagine what their political goal might be, which is maybe someone passes a law that prohibits that kind of testing, and hypothetically in this scenario, maybe that group would stop what they're doing. But what does it look like when a religionist group like the jihadists get their way? I mean, it's not like there's a concrete outcome, except they want to dominate everyone everywhere, which is their goal. And how do you know if they've reached it? I mean, there's ways in which they're not going to stop. It's going to be harder to prove to them that they've failed or that there's no more to pursue. Now, there's different ways you could judge whether they've reached their goals, but I think it's crucial to think about their goals and to have that be part of the starting point. Now, I think you can tell what would stop them, and I have views on that, but you start to get really confused if you start with they happen to use similar means, and then how do you stop them from pursuing their ideological goals? That's a very complicated and roundabout way of looking at the issue. And I don't think it's a promising way to try to untangle this. So those are two observations about where the findings are and the kind of thinking about this as I've pursued it so far. The final point I wanted to raise here is there's a way in which I think my view is definitely that the ideas that a group have a hold and that shape their campaigns and so on, that has to be a primary. And I've been arguing that for a number of years with respect to the Islamist movements, that you need to think of them as an ideological political movement. But it is definitely a complicated issue if you're trying to answer the question, why do certain individuals end up following this or that group? And that's because there's a psychological dimension. And to pick one aspect of that, I think a big part of it has to do with the issue of self-esteem. And again, I'm not speaking as a psychologist, but there's a, you can speak of self-esteem as having relation to one's ideas and one's view of the world, because self-esteem is one's assessment of one's own capability to live and worthiness to live, and so your efficacy and your worthiness. And that is, there's a way in which that can increase or decrease. And if you have irrational ideas, you will see the world in a certain way, in such a way that you don't think you can achieve what you want. You aren't equipped to achieve it, and you aren't worthy of achieving any positive goals in life. So that you can't really separate out. Why does someone decide to go and blow themselves up without really thinking about the way in which their philosophical premises, their philosophic ideas and their stated ideas, how they interact with their psychology? Now, my point is not to say they're all nutcases and this is their, I think that's a cop-out. I think maybe some of them are, and I think irrational ideas such as the ones that the Islamic totalitarians espouse, they definitely will detach you from reality. I mean, that's the, by definition, they're faith-based, and they push you against the facts. They're not there to help you understand the world. And so there's a way in which that can militate toward being detached and having psychological problems, and I think that they go together. So my point is not to let them off the hook by saying, yeah, they're nutcases and they're insane, though they can become that way, and may, and I think some of them join because they have psychological problems. My point is that and this is a crucial point that Ayn Rand has made, that one's psychology and philosophy are connected, and philosophy sets a context. It sets goals, it sets standards and principles, and that has implications for the decisions a person makes and how it shapes his character. From the positive perspective, if you want to be a successful person, you hold rational ideas and act on them, and that will help you create the kind of character that is worthy of living and capable of living, and it will put you in a position to achieve success. And that's one of the most attractive things about the philosophy of objectivism, is that it brings you to, it shows you the path to success and happiness and what you need to do to get there. But if you have irrational ideas, and this is crucial, if you're studying people who have these, who are pursuing irrational goals, it is important to see that those goals will shape their psychology in important ways. This isn't a determinative process. It's not like you accept these ideas and it's all like billiard balls lead you down the path to wearing a suicide belt. That's not my point. It's that you have to see that if you have certain ideas, then your propensity to take certain actions will definitely go along with them. But this is also to highlight that there's a way in which and I'm referring here to the readings I've done so far, there's a way in which this issue can be trivialized by making it, by subdividing it in a way that loses context. So if you just study this as, well, as this thing called rationalization, we see it happen, we're going to try to understand it, it simultaneously throws together things that are very different. The ideas people accept and choose to live by, the impact of those ideas on their minds and their choices. And it also pushes out important things. Well, what is the nature of those ideas and how connected to reality are they? And what impact will that have on their psychology in the sense of real world impact? So I think the idea that we're not going to get a lot more progress, I think, until there's better conceptualization of the issue. And this is just a pitch for, I think there needs to be more thinking on the role of the philosophic ideas that these groups accept. And I'm not arguing against the idea of studying them as practitioners of a certain tactic, but outside of certain contexts, like you're studying tactics, it's not clear to me, and I would argue against packaging them together by their choice of tactics. And especially if you're trying to think about, well, in a certain community, what members of this community or that community, or what profile might you come up with for someone who's more or less likely to join a certain group, which is a complex question and it's a difficult one to solve. But I think you hamper your ability to tackle that if you accept a term which I think is very suspect, and I've been using it in air quotes, this idea of radicalization. So I find this interesting, and this is a point that's worth making, that reading the academic literature on a field, you have to have some background to do that and know your way around it. And I'm just finding my path on this topic in particular. But I find it interesting because there's no end to the kind of questions one can discover and find better answers for. And I mean, I have a reading list that I keep of both articles and books and so on. And it's practically, I don't think I'll ever get through it. And it's not a depressing fact. It's an encouraging fact. There's just so much out there to understand and unravel and really dig into. There's just an amazing, incredible amount of intellectual work to be done in all kinds of fields. I have my own area of expertise, but this is to encourage other people that there's just a lot of intellectual work to be done in all kinds of areas, and problems, political problems as well, to solve, such as what role should such studies have in policy? And maybe it's a good thing that they're not impacting policy thinking, because it's not clear how good some of these articles and studies are. Though, to the extent that they are, it makes sense that they should influence the way we think about these issues. So that is some initial thoughts on this issue of radicalization. It deserves better thinking, I think, and more in-depth analysis. And I guess I would put it this way. There needs to be a greater sensitivity to the role of having valid concepts and really integrating actual phenomena in a rational framework, which I'm not convinced is being done. And I think there's definitely reasons to think the opposite is being done, that assumptions are being made and conceptualizations are put together that don't really fit, and they actually harm our ability to understand these issues. So that's a rather down note, but I'll be back after these messages with what I think is a very different and exciting kind of topic. We'll be right back.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? from a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. 7 great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Welcome back to the Yaron Brook Show. This is Ilan Jurna sitting in for Yaron. I think he is in London and Oxford, England this week, and and in Israel too. I might be getting that wrong, but you can always find out where Ayn Rand Institute speakers are on the road giving talks if you go to our website, aynrand.org. And so I've been talking the last segment about this concept of radicalization related to terrorists and jihadists and so forth. I want to switch gears from something that is not too hopeful and rather dark to something that I found enjoyable, fascinating, and at the same time, I think heartwarming. And you can be the judge. Let me tell you this story. Every night I read to my children before bed, and it was my turn to read to my son. We were reading a book about cars. A picture book that tells you about where the cars first started, what they looked like, what cars can do, how fast they go. And there was a couple of pages on cars of the future. So I was reading this, and I happened to notice that the book was copyrighted in 1991 or 92, so about 25 years ago. So we got to the page about cars to the future, and I was reading the little bit of text next to the picture of each of these cars of the future. And one of them I was explaining to my son, so one day cars of the future will have maps that are computerized, and that these will save the driver's time by figuring out the route and avoid traffic and even avoid bad weather. And my son looked at that and he was sort of puzzled. He had a strange expression on his face, and I turned to him and I said, well, you know, just like the Waze app on my phone that we use to get to school in the morning to avoid traffic. And he said, oh, okay, that makes sense to me. Okay, and then I read another segment on the same page. And this one was about cars that drive themselves. So this is 1991. This is the future in back then. Cars that drive themselves. And I said to him, yeah, you know, like those Google cars, the cars Google and other companies are now testing and they're putting them together. And, you know, like those cars you can buy now that park themselves. It's, oh, yeah, okay, now I get it. And as we were going through this, and there's a number of other examples of cars of the future as seen in the eyes of the past, it struck me that one way to think of the of what we have today is that we are living in the future in an important way. And this reaction that my son had of, well, obviously, what do you mean paper maps? And who has paper maps? And I had to explain that those were the way you found your route in the old days. And I often have conversations with my kids about what it was like in the old days before smartphones and before iPads. They were both born after the advent of those. So they haven't known a world without that kind of technology. And it's an endless source of fascination for me to tell them about what my childhood was like, just because it was recent and some of the things are still around, like the phone that has cables stuck to it and it's stuck to the wall. And they find that amusing and strange and rather pointless, because in their mind, a phone is a thing you look at and you see the person on the other end when you do FaceTime or Skype. I find that encouraging because it's just a blink of an eye since 1991 in my life. And it's incredible how far we have come, and just the kind of technological progress we've seen. It's something to revel in and enjoy, and it's a yet another dramatization in real life, rather than dramatization in fiction, of the role of reason in life. And I enjoy that. I love seeing technological progress. I love gadgets and innovation. And as I said, I have this conversation with my kids very frequently that here's what life was like 50 years ago, 100 years ago. And if you know the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, I point out to them, they drove around in a horse and buggy and a wagon because there were no cars. And they look at me and, oh, there was a time before cars. So on this theme of we're living in the future, I want to mention an article I found recently by an economist called Don Boudreau at a blog called Cafe Hayek. Some of you might know it. And it's if my anecdote about reading to my son about cars of the future, which have technology that is now ubiquitous. This article by Boudreau, it's really well done. It's a good article. And if you're a connoisseur of writing, this is a good example of really concretizing a point dramatically. So this article, I want to share it with you, just a few highlights of it, because I think it really underscores some of the aspects of today's culture that are good and important to celebrate and important to understand and to protect and ensure that we have this kind of value in our world. So a lot of the work that I do, as I've talked about in the last segment, is looking at some of the darker sides of our culture, such as the Islamist movement, the threat we face from them. I study foreign policy more generally, so that's a dismal field. Very little there has gone well, and it's pretty dark. And our political culture more generally can be very dark. But there's a kind of gulf between the realms that are directly impacted by ideas, political ideas and philosophical ideas, such as our political culture and intellectual culture, and the areas where there is still a lot more freedom for reason and people recognize that reason is crucial as opposed to the way they behave in political context. So that's a way to set up this article. So if reading stories from 25 years ago highlighting what the future would look like and we're living in it today, this is a different perspective on the same kind of point, which is what would it look like to live in the past? Now, this is, you probably heard all these stories about, well, people in the past, life expectancy, they were poor and life wasn't so great. And that's true. But this article by Boudreau dramatizes it really in an interesting way because he asks the question, not what would it look like to be a typical person 100 years ago in 1916? Well, you know, a typical person doesn't have a lot of means and not that big an income. He asks the question this way, what would it be like to live as a billionaire in 1916. And the purpose of the article is to show you what would be possible to you if you had, for that time, practically unlimited means. And he there's all sorts of details about how you calculate what it looks like to be a billionaire 100 years ago, all the adjustment for inflation and stuff like that, which I'm not going to get into. But let's just take this conceit as literary concept and try to see what would it look like if you were a billionaire 100 years ago. Well, yes, you probably had a nice apartment. You might even have you might have air conditioning, probably not as good as we have today. Your friends unlikely would. Now, if you wanted to travel to Europe, which today, you know, obviously we do with the drop of a hat, and if you're a billionaire, you might have your own plane. If you were a billionaire 100 years ago, you could go to Europe, obviously. But it would take you, you know, probably a week by boat. Air travel was not nearly what we have today. And now if you wanted to, something we take to be trivial today. So, you know, my house is continually receiving boxes from Amazon because we order all kinds of stuff from them and books endlessly. Now, what if you wanted to, and Amazon ships stuff overnight now, sometimes same day. But suppose 100 years ago, you wanted to deliver a package or a letter to someone from New York to LA, right? Well, you couldn't. It's just impossible. There's no technological means of doing that. It's just, even for a billionaire, you could not do that. And today, it's $11 on FedEx to do overnight from New York to LA. or practically anywhere in the world, it's a little bit more. Now, what if you wanted to relax? What if you just wanted to kick up your heels and just listen to some music? Well, you would probably need to get someone to play the music for you, because radio hadn't started, I think, until 1920s, and obviously there was no TV. Now, you could probably get a phonograph. Some of you listening have never heard of a phonograph. That's sort of like a CD player with an old-timey record. And at the time, they weren't even flat. Some of them were discs. Now, you could get one of those, and you could maybe find some songs or classical music. But you couldn't get basically everything that's ever been published on iTunes Music or Spotify or Apple Music streamed to your phone wirelessly whenever you want, for however you want. Playlists that predict, like Pandora, if you guys know it. Pandora has this really smart technology where you play a few songs, you rate them, and it predicts whether it sort of figures out what kind of songs you like and plays those for you, or you can create whole playlists like that, because it has some sort of computer technology in the back that learns your preferences and profile. Nothing like that was possible for a billionaire 100 years ago. So if you had unlimited means. So Boudreaux goes through a whole bunch of examples like this. You know, what if your Wi-Fi connection was really slow? Well, obviously you didn't have Wi-Fi 100 years ago, and obviously you didn't have computers. All the things that save us time and money and thought and make our lives so much more pleasant. Now, this is an example that I think is worth dwelling on a little longer. He asks the question about what if you needed medical care? You know, if you have an inkling of medical science, it's really progressed in the 100 years since 1916. It wasn't what it is today. Anyway, according to him, it was pretty hard, and I think that's an understatement. You just think about the diseases that were rampant at the time and the things that are now vaccinated for. Millions of people died from diseases that are being completely eradicated from the world since then. But what if you had something which we think of as a, you know, first world problem, something like a sexual dysfunction, like erectile dysfunction? What would happen to you back then? Well, you could probably talk to psychologists, but if they were under the influence of some of the thinkers of the time, I don't think they would have helped you much. There was no Viagra, no whatever competitors it has now. I looked this up. There's three of them now. There are now competing medicines for that kind of problem. Well, what if you had something that really affected your day-to-day life, like bipolar disorder or some other psychological thing, psychological condition that really affected the quality of your life day-to-day, minute-to-minute, you know, like some of the depression drugs that you can get today? Well, they just didn't exist. And that is regardless of your means of buying them. And those are important. So I've given examples, and Boudreaux's piece has lots of examples of the kind of material comforts and conveniences and innovations that we have all around. But it's important to see as well the psychological, or you can think of them as spiritual side of human life that are important. I think advances have really enriched our lives. It's an understatement. The fascinating thing here, there's so many examples that this thing is dense with examples, like birth control and how that's changed people's lives. All that has happened in the span of just 100 years, and you could multiply the examples. Just dwell on that for a while and think, if you had whatever your income level is today, the things you can afford that a billionaire 100 years ago, it was beyond his reach. Not only because there was no money, you couldn't buy it. It was just did not exist. The sort of things that have now ubiquitous, from an iPhone that plays practically anything that's ever been recorded in terms of music or movies that are endlessly streamable, to overnight shipping, to air travel, to routine air travel, where we have this concept of a road warrior, someone whose job it is to be on the road flying back and forth all the time. It's just impossible to imagine. And just the internet, which has blossomed and created a world that no one could have imagined possible 100 years ago. So I mention all this because in a certain way, it's not that the world is, I don't want to leave you the impression of there's the good news and there's the bad news and you kind of have to figure it out. It's just it's, to understand the culture and understand the world we live in, it's important not to become sort of narrowly looking at just the good things and then you feel good about them and then you ignore all the bad things or just look at the bad things and ignore the good things. It's important to conceptualize the world we live in, and it's really torn in various directions with there are areas of the culture that are really progressing in important ways, and I think technology is one area like that. And the work that you find in Silicon Valley is just incredible. And then the other areas of our culture, notably in politics and intellectual life, that are not just falling apart or failing or just irrational in various ways. They're regressing to a point where we ought to know better. We have experience of the impact of certain policies and doctrines that we should know that socialism really leads to what Venezuela looks like today. That it is not an accident that Venezuela looks the way it does. And if you've not followed that story, it is just heart-wrenching to see what's happening in that country. Now, that big divide is a result, and it's not to say that the areas that are progressing are, you know, pristine and unaffected by these ideas, but or by influences that are detrimental. But it's important not to make sort of draw conclusions that ignore the mixed character of the culture that we live in, because as one of my closest friends used to tell me when I was complaining about the state of the world, this is the best time to be alive in many important ways. Like if you are looking for medical advances and technological advances, the world has never been better in those respects. And then politically, yeah, the world is in a rocky state. It's really bad in many ways. And I'm not here to sell you on a Pollyanna vision of what's going on in the world. But at the same time, I think it's important to sort out what's going on and understand it and see where what really drives progress and what hampers it and what destroys and undermines it. And I think this is an important assignment for everyone because it has an impact on the way you experience the world, how you cope with it, what you enjoy, the kind of things you celebrate. And it is important to celebrate good things in the world because there are many good things, both in science and technology and in the arts. And just recognize that because that's important to see that this is the world. There are a lot of good things out there that we ought to celebrate and explain to people why they're possible and what it takes to keep them going. And I think the cardinal ones are reason and freedom. Those are the crucial pillars of a free society. And without them, this kind of progress can't long endure. But to the extent that we have controls and so forth, even with a little bit of freedom, it's amazing what's possible. And it's important as well from a different perspective to recognize the good things in the world and the virtuous behavior that you see and the amazing kind of advances. Because imagine a world where there's, you know, a millionfold of that, where that is multiplied many times over. Well, that's the kind of world that I fight for, and I hope so many of you fight for, and that we try to advocate the right kind of ideas and persuade people that, yeah, that is a vision of the future that you can see glimpsed in small ways today and all across our lives. So if you want to live in the future, you can. We're living in it in various ways today, but we can bring the future into reality, by which I mean we can bring a society of freedom into reality if we pursue the right ideas and advocate and persuade people that a free society is the way to go. And there's a lot of work to do that. And one of the assets we have is to show them this is what it looks like. This is the kind of progress you can have to the extent that people are free and able to think and produce. We'll be back after these messages.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth, the man who found the lost city of Atlantis, a modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, who cares? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn, and the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem, these works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, welcome back. This is Yaron Brook Show, and I'm Ilan Jurna sitting in for him. Welcome. Three quick things I want to do this part of the show. One is to tell you, last time I was on, I talked quite a bit about OCON, Objectivist Summer Conference 2016. I want to do just a quick mention of a couple of things about that, which I didn't get a chance to do last time. I did an unscientific poll on Twitter, and I mean unscientific with a big X underline there, not a real poll, to ask people what they know about OCON, if they're coming or not. And this is a few months ago. One of the responses I got quite a bit was, what's OCON? And so this is one reason I want to talk about it again. You should find out. It's a really exciting event. I'll be there. So will Yaron and a few of our colleagues. I want to give you three quick highlights about what you could expect. One, Harry Binswanger, who came up in our conversation earlier with Keith Lockich. Dr. Binswanger is a longtime associate of Ayn Rand. He's the editor of the second edition of The Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. He's a longtime scholar of Rand's work. He's a philosopher. He used to publish and contribute a lot of the content to the Objectivist Forum, which is a very important publication many years ago. And he's a board member of the Ayn Rand Institute. Now, he will be speaking at Objectivist Summer Conference in Seattle at OCON about one of his, this is his recent book, How We Know. And the title of the course is The Foundations of Knowledge, which I think is going to be a really important and exciting course. I'm looking forward to that. Now, he hasn't spoken at OCON for quite a number of years, so this is an occasion, I think, to look forward to. So that is one highlight. Number two, there's a sequence of presentations throughout the conference that I think will inspire a lot of people. It's sort of a can't-lose proposition, in my view. The title is Spiritual Fuel, Appreciating Various Forms of Art. Now, if you don't like movies, okay. Well, if you don't like painting, okay. If you don't like music, okay. If you don't like sculpture, well I haven't yet met someone who dislikes art altogether. There's usually some form of art that people do enjoy. Whichever one it is, or if you like them all, I think you'll have something to get out of this sequence of presentations. And it's by different speakers each day. There are both scholars of Ayn Rand's works and scholars of the theory of art and of literature speaking, and also practitioners. So someone who's a painter, a sculptor, a filmmaker, a musician. And the point of these is to help people get more out of the art forms that they like. So I think that will be quite something there to hear from people who create art about how to think about art, how to experience art in a way that heightens your enjoyment of it. And the third highlight I wanted to mention is, did you know this? I just heard this today, so I'm excited about this. I tweeted it, and I want to tell people about this. If you're a student, and that we define that pretty broadly from high school to college, as long as you're in a program, and even alumni of the Objectivist, not alumni, current OAC students, so it's a very broad definition of student. If you're a student, OCON looks like a big pile of money that you have to shell out. Well, no. We have full scholarships and partial scholarships still available, which was really amazing to me. So I want to mention this because if you are a student and you're considering coming, do apply. You can still be accepted and get in some cases, full scholarship, and these are based on merit and also travel distance. You can apply online. Definitely do it. It's an amazing experience if you're a student. There are a lot of students already signed up from what I hear. When I first went to OCON, I was a student myself. I was an undergraduate. It was great to meet other people, connect with them. And I think the scene at the Objectivist Conference for students has just grown and grown and become richer and more exciting. So if you're a student, there are full scholarships waiting to be applied for. Do consider that. And if you don't know a lot about OCON, go online and find out objectivistconferences.com, or you can go to our website, AynRandInstitute.org, to find out more. And sign up, you can get information about new material added to the program and the schedule and so on. Highly recommend that. So OCON, I'll say one last thing about this, which is it is a conference for people interested in Ayn Rand's philosophy and ideas and want to get more knowledge and deepen their understanding. And I'll say that it's important to see how Ayn Rand thought of her philosophy, and that was, it was a philosophy for living on Earth. It was something that enabled you to live a better life, the best life you can, and it's a means of achieving your own happiness and success, and I can't imagine a better way to spend time equipping yourself for that kind of future. All right, so that's OCON. Very excited about that. And a couple of other things before I get to the contest, which I want to explain and then encourage you to take part. Do you ever get the question, or do you ever meet people, maybe you've had this experience yourself reading Ayn Rand, which is, it seems like, or some people think, she's really just a propagandist. You know, all these are novels that are, these are, you know, lectures pretending to be novels, or she's sort of an advocate more than she is an artist. This is a question that comes up a lot, and Ayn Rand got this question from people, and I can see where people are coming from when they have this question. And there was a post on the website of FEE, Foundation for Economic Education, and a lot of respect for what they do there. I know some of the staff. They do good work, and we collaborate with them, but they published an article that basically raised this question, is Ayn Rand a writer of didactic fiction, which means fiction that is meant to teach rather than just fiction that is art? And one of my colleagues, Ankar Gatte, has written a blog post that I want to recommend to you. And it asks that question, is Ayn Rand a writer of didactic fiction? And Ankar presents an answer to that, which I think is really illuminating. Because part of what he says is, before you can answer that question, you have to ask about what categories are you using to evaluate art? What are the categories you're using to evaluate how artists pursue their goals? And if you have a view on that, and Ayn Rand had her own view of what it looks like to pursue art and what art is, then you look at the issue very differently. And I think the answer is really fascinating. So it's quite a lengthy blog post. You can find that on our website that I highly recommend that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes as well for you guys. One other thing, and again, a question. I've talked about free speech in the context of Islamist attacks on free speech. I recently wrote a blog post about Fleming Rose, who is the Danish journalist who commissioned and published the notorious, or now notorious, cartoons of Muhammad about 11 years ago. And you might know that the Institute has been very active on the topic of free speech and the need to defend it. I wrote the blog post about Fleming Rose because he won a prize for his work upholding freedom of speech, and I think it's well deserved, and I'm pleased about that. You can find my blog post on the web. But this all raises a question that sometimes I find. I was at a seminar some time ago with some lawyers and really smart people, and one of the questions was sort of, well, you know, in America we have the First Amendment, and moreover we have you know, a lot of the jurisprudence, and this is not my view, but apparently this is all true, and I believe it, that a lot of the jurisprudence has gone in the right direction, strengthening freedom of speech in certain areas. So what's the big deal, in effect? And I don't mean to characterize that view as I think there's something to that view, because there's definitely data you can point to, and it's a case you can make. But I think that's not really I don't think it's a good conclusion. I don't think it's the right view to take. It's too narrow. It's not putting the issue of free speech in its proper context. And on that theme, how to think about the threats to free speech, and especially given that America has the First Amendment, which many countries, as far as I know, do not have an equivalent to that, you know, constitutional protection for free speech. So America is distinctive in that sense, and perhaps unique. I haven't really studied that. Given that we have the First Amendment to protect free speech, is it enough? And that was the question that is the title for a talk that my colleague Steve Simpson gave recently, and that you can now find on YouTube. The whole presentation is recorded. I highly recommend it. Steve is director of legal studies here at the Institute. He's an experienced lawyer, a constitutional lawyer, studies the law and writes about it. It's a really important topic. We've talked about free speech. He was here filling in for Yaron some weeks back talking about freedom of speech. So I want to highly recommend that you check out this talk that he gave. Is the First Amendment enough? And I think the answer, not to be a spoiler, but the answer is no, but the ways in which First Amendment is inadequate are important to understand and important to explain to people so that they see the real value at stake and what needs to happen and what work is needed to protect freedom of speech in America. So I highly recommend Ankar's blog post about Ayn Rand's fiction and Steve's talk about First Amendment and free speech threats to free speech. All right, let's draw a line there. I want to tell you about a contest. So I did a contest some time ago when I was on Yaron's show. I had a lot of fun with it, and I think some of you guys did too. So I want to set the question. Well, let me tell you what's in it for you. So the prize, let's start with that. The prize is the glory testing your knowledge, but concretely, we can offer you a copy of Equal is Unfair. I think we can get you a T-shirt. We'll have to figure out your size, obviously. And I can throw in a copy of my book, Winning the Unwinnable War. And I'm going to look for a few other things to throw into the pot, too. But at least those three things are the prize. That's what's in it for you. You get to test your knowledge and have some fun. And those are the prizes. Now, what do you need to answer to win this contest? Well, you need to submit an answer to this question. If you've read Equal is Unfair, you will get the basic point that they present. And if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. You've probably heard commercials for it in the breaks. It's a really good book, important issue, and I think it'll equip you to think about the issue of income inequality and the related topics, particularly since it's so prominent now. Now, in that book, there are points they make, and the basic thrust of the book is distinctive, and I think it's distinctive in its emphasis on the values that are at stake, production and thought and freedom, and the freedom for people of ability to succeed in the world, and that there's a great deal to say about that. And I think another way to put it is the book unmasks the actual character, or the real motives, if you will. This is my characterization. The book unmasks the actual character of the inequality crusaders, the people who are trying to eliminate economic inequality. And there's a lot wrong with that, and Don and Iran have done important work to explain that, both in the book and in their writings. So the question I want you to answer is this. Ayn Rand has written on this issue from a certain perspective. Obviously, she wrote many years ago. There are two essays in particular that I want you to name as closely connected to the issue of inequality and to the themes in Equal is Unfair. And you just need to tell me the titles of those two essays. Now, there are at least two, so you need to get the two that I have in mind. You could argue a case for others of her essays that are germane to this, but I'm going to limit it to two essays. It doesn't matter where they are, just tell me the names of them. And how do you enter? Well, I'm going to put a link on Twitter and pin it to my account, and we'll put it in the show notes. You basically follow the link, enter your answer, your email, so we can get in touch with you if you win, and we will randomly pick one of the correct answers to win the prize. And we're going to hold, since this is going to be a show that people listen to, both on Saturday and afterwards, we're going to extend the deadline through to May 25. So even if you're listening after Saturday, you can still enter as long as you submit by 11:59 p.m. Pacific time on May 25, you can enter to win. So just to recap, there are two essays by Ayn Rand that are relevant to the themes in Equal is Unfair, specifically the issue of inequality. And I want you to name what they are. So this is a test of your background knowledge and Ayn Rand's thinking and sort of the application of her ideas to current issues. And just, I think it'll be interesting to see what people come back with. You enter on the web.
So let me mention my Twitter handle, which you'll need to connect with me and get information about the contest. You can find me at @ElanJourno, @ElanJourno.
And if you win, you get Equal is Unfair, a t-shirt, and a copy of my book, and maybe a few other things. So I hope you enter, and I look forward to seeing who wins. And I will also, since the people submit the answers through a form, you won't know who wins until I announce it. Probably do that on the 26th or 27th of May. I look forward to seeing what you guys come up with. So that's the contest. Looking forward to that. All right, so I want to draw a line here. It's been fun chatting with you guys and covering these topics. I hope to be back sometime soon. I think we have Iran coming up in next week. Is that right? No, we have another guest host for you, but Iran will be back. And I'm sure you guys are eager to hear who's going to fill in for him. You will discover that with the announcement of the next program. With that, I'll close and thank you for your attention and time.